Welcome to A Monday and the Record on KUOW Seattle. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. First off today, what kind of power does a majority hold? Democrats have had the majority in the state legislature for 30 days now, and Governor Jay Inslee is pleased so far.
I think it's fair to say that the dam is broken and that progress is being made in Olympia, and that's good news for the people of the state of Washington.
Okay, dam is broken, but Republican Senate Minority Leader, he used to be the Majority Leader, now he's in the minority, Mark Schessler, says the bills that have made it through the dam, through this session, they're not actually what voters want.
I really didn't hear a pent-up demand for some of the issues that were voted on immediately. I did hear interest in budget, taxes, education, but not on social issues.
So, what has actually been accomplished in these first 30 days of the legislative session, and what can you expect for the 30 to come? KUOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, joins us from the state capitol. Welcome, Austin.
Good to be here, Bill.
So, you just heard from a couple of partisans there. What do you think? How has Democratic control changed things so far?
Well, it certainly seems like, at least in the state Senate, where there's this newfound Democratic majority, that they sort of, you know, were shot out of the cannon in these first 30 days. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of pent-up Democratic bills and desires to move on things that they hadn't been able to do when Republicans controlled that chamber, and they wanted to establish that majority for themselves, but also for their base, for their constituencies. And so they used that time to really get themselves on the map and prove that they do have control, albeit it's only one vote.
And what are some big examples of that?
Well, you know, a good example would be what supporters call the Reproductive Parity Act. This is a bill that requires health insurers that cover maternity care to also cover abortions and contraceptives without copays or deductibles. This is a bill that Democrats first introduced back in 2012, right before Republicans took control of the state Senate, and has languished ever since. So that got through the state Senate. There was a bill to ban so-called gay conversion therapy that's passed off the Senate floor in this first half of the session. Also, a campaign finance bill that deals with dark money in state politics that has also been held back in recent years. So they were right out of the gates trying to get some of these bills that had languished across at least the Senate finish line.
Yes, that's only one of the finish lines. So you just mentioned abortion, contraceptive coverage, gay conversion therapy ban, money in politics. Which of those are actually going to pass?
Well, that's a good question, because the other thing to remember about the political dynamics here is that, yes, while Democrats have control of both chambers and the governor's office, first off, these are very narrow majorities. And secondly, the priorities of the Democrats in the state Senate may not be the priorities of the Democrats in the state House. And anytime you get to controversial issues, and I'm thinking now gun control, for instance, taxation, it's very hard to muster a majority. It's easy to lose votes. And so then the political calculus has to be for Democrats, can we pick up a couple Republican votes here and there to offset the ones we're losing on our own side? Things start to get tricky as you move through this sausage-making process.
Okay, let's take one of those examples, Austin, a very minor version of gun control. This is a bill that passed the state Senate, a ban on bump stocks. Now, before the session, I asked the Senate Republican leader, Mark Schessler, about banning bump stocks, and this is what he said.
Well, first I got to find out what one is. As a firearm owner, I don't even know what one is. I doubt if the governor does either.
Well, you know, this is that thing that automatically bumps against the trigger and makes it fire like an automatic weapon.
Well, you know, first of all, as I've been told, there's never been one used in the commission of a crime in the state of Washington. So we haven't found the problem.
It's most famous from the Las Vegas shooting.
Right, but Washington's never had one in the commission of a crime. It was originally an Obama-era rule for people with disabilities that like to shoot semi-autos. So I don't personally see the need for a problem, but I guess we'll take a look and see if there is a problem and first learn what one is before we try to ban it.
Well, Austin Jenkins, now Senator Schessler cannot say he doesn't know what a bump stock is. How did he vote, and what's the fate of that bill?
He voted no on the ban. This did come to the floor of the state Senate. Interestingly, the final vote was 29-20, so Democrats did pick up four Republicans. Mark Schessler was not one of them. In fact, the final bill, the final striking amendment, was crafted by a Senate Republican, Hans Iger. It was also prime sponsored by a state senator who says he's a lifetime member of the NRA. But It does go over to the House now, and there seems to be some question about whether it will pass. The answer back from the House leadership has been, we're going to have to caucus on this. That's kind of Olympia code for, we don't know if we have the votes. There are some pretty conservative rural Democrats in that caucus who may feel like anything that even approaches the idea of gun control is just anathema to them. And again, it may be a calculation of, do they have the votes with Democrats and a few Republicans to do this? But I'll tell you what, and it may surprise a Seattle audience, but anything related to restricting access to guns or equipment that goes with guns is a very tough sell in Olympia, even in the wake of a mass shooting like we saw in Las Vegas.
We're catching you up on the first month of the Washington State Legislature with our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. And Austin, the second big issue you mentioned was taxation. And there's a version of the governor's carbon tax plan in the Senate, and that would be a $10 a ton tax on carbon. And you say it looks like a long shot. Why is that?
Right. I mean, do not underestimate the significance of this passing out of committee. I mean, that if for close watchers, any yardage you can get on an issue, even just getting it out of committee, even if it dies at that point, is not insignificant. But when you combine the fact that this is a new tax, it's a short election year session, there are Democrats who don't support this, and most Republicans are saying no to this, and it does have the potential for driving up energy costs for low-income and middle-class families in Washington. It's a tough sell. But, you know, the governor is doubling down and tripling down and saying this is something he wants. And there's also the threat, if you want to view it as such, or the promise of a ballot measure in 2018. Environmental groups, labor organizations, tribes are kind of waiting in the wings. If the legislature doesn't act on this, they're likely to go to the ballot. And so for the business community, that's a calculation they have to think about. It was better to try to craft something in the legislative environment, or wait and see what the advocates write in their draft and put on the ballot.
Don't suppose you care to make a carbon tax prediction?
My prediction is it doesn't pass in 2018, at least out of the legislature.
Okay. Yeah, and then initiative?
Anytime you're going to the ballot and trying to tax people, it's a tough sell. The general rule of thumb is you've got to come in the day that you get the signatures to get on the ballot, you got to have 60% approval for whatever idea you have, because you're only going to lose ground from there. And I don't think the carbon tax has 60% approval. The advocates, though, think they can run a compelling campaign that will convince enough Washington voters to do this, and they certainly seem prepared to go to the ballot, likely in 2018.
We haven't even mentioned schools yet. I assume as we head into the second half of the 2018 legislative session, that's going to be a big focus. So what's up with schools, and what else do you think we should look for in the last 30 days?
Yeah, the second half, it's going to go by quickly, but we're awaiting supplemental budget proposals, because this is the midterm of the two-year budget cycle, so they got to make their tweaks to the budget. Part of that will be some response to the state Supreme Court saying that while the legislature last year did fully fund schools, their plan meets constitutional muster, they're about $1 billion short for the next school year, the 2018-19 school year. What's interesting is Republicans have been suggesting that the legislature should, in essence, ignore the court on this and say, you know, we've done our job on this McCleary school funding case. Democrats are saying, we're not sure another billion just for teacher salaries and staff salaries is the right way to go. Maybe we should put more money into special education and some other parts of education and see if that, you know, we'll decide the priority. The court, yeah, we'll give you more money. We'll give the schools more money, but we're going to decide where that money goes. So it'll be interesting to see the solution that comes out of this. The big question will be, what does the court do after it sees what the legislature does? And if it satisfies the court, fine. If not, then there's the potential for greater sanctions.
Finally, Austin, I'm just about to talk with David Leonhardt from the New York Times, who wrote about the trend of people bringing pets into planes and restaurants and calling them service animals. This is something that the Washington legislature is also looking into. What do you think is going to happen there?
Hard to know, but I'll tell you what, it's really hard to vote against a dog, especially. There's a lot of dog lovers, and I'll tell you that there are dogs on this campus. There are dogs in some of these legislative offices. There was a proposal many years ago to allow dogs in bars. I'm saying that the dog vote's pretty strong in Olympia.
They are adorable. Austin Jenkins, also adorable. KUOW's Olympia correspondent. Thanks a lot, Austin.
You're welcome.
And you can follow Austin's reporting on Olympia by tuning into KUOW, or, of course, by going to our website, KUOW.org. Service animals that aren't really service animals, and more importantly, what it says about American culture today. The New York Times' David Leonhardt in a moment. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Yes, the Washington legislature is trying to fund education, and they're debating a carbon tax, but what about the animals? Lawmakers are considering making it a crime to pretend that your pet is a service animal, up to a $250 fine. The lawmakers are reacting to a national trend of pet fakery, culminating last week in the peacock.
I'm not kidding. This woman is wrangling her peacock into the airport. Right now, wrangling a peacock in the airport.
It's emotional support.
Yep. That happens all the time.
What the hell, New York?
Speaking of New York, from the New York Times, columnist David Leonhardt is writing about this in the bigger picture. David, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you talked about Dexter the peacock and these other fake service animals as a sign of eroding trust. Would you say more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, on some level, this is kind of a fun and light topic. But I think there are a couple serious issues in the particular part of the idea of bringing airplanes on animals on planes in terms of how it affects people with animals and kids and stuff like that, people with allergies. But I also think there's a larger point here, which is we've gotten inured to this idea that thousands and thousands of people are just going to lie. They're going to say this is an emotional support animal, when in fact it's just their pet. It's not an emotional support animal. And as more people lie and they say this is my emotional support animal, and maybe they go online and they pay $100 and they have some faraway therapist claim that they have an emotional need that leads for them to have the pet, other people see this and they say, wait a second, if they're lying and benefiting from it, I'm going to lie too, and I'm going to bring my animal on and call my animal an emotional support animal. And I think what that does is, in small ways, is it erodes the notion of trust. And when societies have trust erode, it's just not a good thing. Societies function so much better when people can assume that their fellow citizens are acting in good faith.
David, I'm not done yet deciding whether this is a trend, because selfishness has always been with us. I'm thinking of tax cheats. I'm thinking of steroids, and I could go on. How else have you seen this erosion of trust be a modern thing?
Well, I'm not necessarily suggesting that there's less trust than there has ever been. I think, to me, the bigger issue is that this is a new example of it, right? And so when a new example of it comes up, I don't think we should simply let it go and say, well, it's fine that these people are going to, and as I say in the column, I think the people doing this are overwhelmingly decent people. I don't think we should step back and say, well, it's fine that we now have tens of thousands of people lying about their pets in order to bring them on planes. I think it's important to say, look, this is small bits of cheating. And while to the pet owners, I get why they are saying, well, this is my pet and I love my pet and my pet would never hurt anyone, it actually does exact costs on everyone else. A lot of kids, little kids, do not want to be in small spaces with large animals. And having a pet owner say, my animal won't hurt you, doesn't actually help the little kid. A lot of people have allergies to pets, that being next to one in a cramped space isn't good. I was really struck for reporting this column and talking to people who work for the airlines about how unpleasant it's gotten. The number of people who are getting in arguments on planes over animals. This news release that Delta just put out that talked about biting and urinating and defecation by the animals on the planes.
Not your average corporate press release.
Not your average corporate press release. And so as I say in the column, I am well aware this is not the most urgent issue facing the country. But I wish we could get back to a norm of traveling where you didn't have people going on Amazon and buying these emotional support vests for $30 and just deciding that it doesn't really matter if you cheat the system because it benefits you.
Could it be we're getting more selfish because we see ourselves getting the shaft so much, not only from airlines that shrink our seats and charge us fees, but from a country set up in so many ways for the rich and powerful?
I do think airlines have some blame here in this case, in a few different ways. One, they now charge $125 each way to bring a pet in a bag under your seat. That's a lot of money. Two, I know a lot of pet owners feel that the conditions in cargo holds for pets are not safe. If you look at the numbers, not a lot of pets have died, but too many of them have died, several dozen over some number of years. And airlines say, well, the rate is actually, you know, approaching zero. But obviously those stories have real resonance. And as you say, flying is just pretty unpleasant. And I do think the unpleasantness of flying makes people more willing to cheat in order to make it just a little bit less unpleasant.
Well, I know people have always complained about maybe not the cheating, but the selfishness of bringing a baby on an airplane. Do you see, though, I asked you earlier about a trend. I mean, is this of wider significance? Are you concerned about an erosion of our social fabric when people say, well, I'm going to look out for me?
Two things. I am concerned about it. The main reason I'm concerned about it is not this pet. It's instead the other stuff we see and we talk about all the time, right? The nastiness on social media, the idea of people organizing themselves into tribes, and if you decide that someone's not part of your tribe, then you basically decide that they are evil. You said something about babies. I really would put babies in a different category. I mean, I think we're now getting into, kind of ethical questions that everyone has to decide for themselves, but I believe human beings are more important than animals. And I think, I think babies, to me, bringing a baby on a flight is not selfish. People should be able to fly with their babies. Never bothers me if I'm on a flight when a baby's screaming. I mean, it bothers me, but I mainly just feel bad for the parent who has the screaming baby. To me, the idea that we get to the point where, 50-pound dog has the same rights as a 5-pound baby strikes me as an indication that we may have some of our priorities a little off.
As we're speaking, David Leonhardt from the New York Times, someone in Seattle is on social media calling you a horrible person for saying that babies are more important than animals. To your earlier point.
And I'm very comfortable standing on the ground that babies are more important than animals.
Okay. And since we're wringing our hands here, I also want to bring up a column you wrote about your wishes for 2018 recently. And, it included not just some wishes, but some notes of hope. I don't expect you to memorize the column, but I want to talk to you about any optimism you have as you daily, your job is to survey this country.
I appreciate you bringing it up. I'm by nature an optimistic person, and I think it's worth being optimistic when you look at the long history of this country, right? This is a country that, while deeply imperfect, has over time tended to expand rights for nearly every group of people, right? There is more religious freedom and less religious discrimination than there used to be. There is much less bigotry directed toward the LGBT community than there used to be. While racism is a terrible problem in our society, as Barack Obama once said, don't tell me that race relations haven't improved unless you lived as a black man in this country in the 1950s and 60s. And so I think the long arc of history in this country is toward progress. What's so alarming about the current period is it feels like we're sliding backwards on some of these things. I still retain hope that this period will end up looking more like a pause than the beginning of a new trend. And to me, one reason for that hope is the relatively strong performance of different institutions in the face of attacks from the current president, whether it's the judiciary, whether it's scientists, whether it's the intelligence community, whether it's the media, you name it, lots of institutions have not folded in the face of attacks from the president. And I think that's reason for optimism.
Well, we certainly have our institutional checks and balances. What is new, as you said earlier, is for one thing, social media. What about that counter trend? Where do you think that tribalism is taking this country?
What's interesting when you think about social media and the media is it's important not to overly glamorize the past, right? In the past,
yes,
we basically had a set of media in which a relatively small group of people, nearly all of whom, let's be honest, were white men, were deciding what was in the media, what people were going to read and what they were going to hear. And now we have a much more free and open and small d democratic media system. And that brings some real challenges, the tribalism that you and I have both mentioned. It creates business challenges for media organizations. particularly local ones. But let's also realize that there are some benefits and that it allows people to participate much more in conversations when they could in the past. So in the past, if I wrote an article about dogs that you thought was horrible, you had to write a letter to the New York Times and hope that it was one of the few that got published. Now, if I write an article about dogs that you don't like, you can put your comments on Facebook and they can circulate among your friends. And there's a version of that that I actually think is much more in keeping with our values as a democratic nation. We just have to figure out ways to guard against, I think, two main things. One is the tribalism, the idea that we don't listen to anyone we disagree with. I think it's really important to listen to people you disagree with, hear their arguments, think about what the problems are with your own argument. And then, two, that we distinguish between things that are clearly false and things that are not. You and I can have a good argument, or I can have a good argument with anyone about whether dogs should be allowed on planes, and that is, we should have that argument. We should disagree. We should not have an argument about whether the Earth is getting warmer, or whether the Pope endorsed Donald Trump, or any number of things that are simple matters of fact. And I think we're still sorting through how to deal with that in the new media environment.
There's some practical optimism amid the peacocks.
Exactly.
And despite the dander. David Leonhardt from the New York Times, I enjoy reading you every day, and thanks for this time. Hope we can do it again.
Thanks for saying that, and I'd love to come back on.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. Maybe you want to react to my conversation with David Leonhardt, talking about the wither America, which way our society. Join us on Twitter, at KUOW, and on Facebook, too. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The man you're about to meet says he's ashamed of what he did. He says it's a healthy shame that he can use to help people who used to be like him. In the 1980s, Tony McAleer was a skinhead in Vancouver, British Columbia. He was deeply involved in the white Aryan resistance, anti-immigrant activism, Holocaust denial, and street violence. Some of it here in Seattle. He says he used to come down to the University District to pick fights. Today, he runs a group called Life After Hate. It's dedicated to helping people leave the violent far right. And he agreed to tell me what changed him. Tony McAleer, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You were a skinhead recruiter in the 1990s, and you've said at that time you were feeling less than. What does that mean, less than?
That's a great question. And I first came across an understanding of what that is from John Bradshaw's book, Healing the Shame That Binds You. And I think what research shows is it's not ideology that pulls people into these movements. They're driven by deeper psychological factors. And as a young person growing up, it can happen at school, it can happen at church, it can happen in the family, where your environment sends you the message that you're not good enough, not pretty enough, not smart enough.
How is the environment sending you that message?
I had a father that was emotionally unavailable, and you know, even though we lived under the same house, he worked 70 hours a week, so I never saw him. You know, I remember when I was 10, I walked in on him with another woman, and my grades started to slide. And by the time I was 11, I'd gone from an A student to a C student, and the Catholic school I went to got together with my dad and my mom, and they all agreed that they should try and beat the grades back into me. And if I didn't get an A or a B on major tests and assignment, I was hit on the rear end with a yardstick over and over and over again. And that left me very confused, very angry. I went from listening to Queen and Elton John to The Clash and the Sex Pistols. And it was music that really vibed with where I was at. It was, you know, it was angry. And you know, because I remember those times I was in that teacher's office getting caned, I don't think I'd ever felt more powerless, even to this day, than I did in that room. And there's this weird thing about human nature. You know, when we're dominated and humiliated, we want to do that to other people.
Well, Tony, a lot of us have felt powerless at times, and I'm sorry you did, but obviously most of us aren't taking that out on minority groups? I mean, what was it in you that was doing that?
Right, and I just want to be very clear. I don't blame anything on my childhood, right? I just provide that as the lens and the backdrop to what was going on. Everything I did, I chose to do. You know, back to this feeling of less than, toxic shame. It's the driver to a whole host, a whole spectrum of antisocial outcomes, of which racism and violent extremism is one, violence, gang violence is another, addiction. Most of the time, people commit the violence to themselves. But I chose to do it to other people, and I chose a music subculture which gave me permission and encouraged me to do that.
How did that lead you, though, to being toxically violent toward other people? I think some of us could imagine some of your feelings, but we want to know what...
Right, because it wasn't racist at that point, right? But it was violent. You know, when I first met these skinheads in Vancouver, and it was after I'd been to boarding school in England, where there was 300,000 skinheads in England, then I remember meeting them outside the New York Theater on Commercial Drive, and I was wearing my Doc Martens, and they were dime a dozen in England, and these guys come up, and they go, "What size feet you have?" And I know why they were asking. They were going to rob me from my Doc Martens. I lied and said 7.5. And the one guy looked at the other and said, they wouldn't fit you. And they walked away. My bullying survival strategy was befriend the bully, become the bully. And those two guys became my best friends. And in order for me to have their protection, I had to have their respect. In order for me to have their respect, I had to commit all the same violence that they did. And the first time I started committing violence, I liked it. The adrenaline rush. I remember thinking at the time, like, this is addictive.
Who was your victim? Who were you being violent?
Two drunk guys at a party that, you know, said something to us because we were dressed different than everybody else. And it wasn't we just picked someone and just started beating them. What we got really good at is manufacturing the provocation. So you could say it was in self-defense. But that's where it started. And then starting to get a reputation, and there's fear and notoriety around when you walked into a punk show and people are avoiding you and stuff like that, and walking down the street and people going to the other side of the street. I got a sense of power when I'd felt powerless, right? I got a sense of acceptance and belonging when I'd felt unlovable. And I got attention when I'd felt invisible. And so this shame, I'm not talking healthy shame, like, we live our lives in reaction to that. So what's an opposite word to shame?
Pride?
What are these groups all about? A manufactured false sense of pride. Because
yeah, white pride.
White pride. So they're operating from a pride deficit, the shame.
How did you turn that against other groups and why?
If I look at it now, there's no logical explanation why I did that. I did it. I chose to do that. But I was getting all these other needs met that had nothing to do with the ideology. And when the music scene turned virulently racist and violently racist, and the music that we were listening to, then there was all this fantasy ideals of Viking warriors and the hero archetype and this journey to, we actually believed we were going to save the world, that there was this Jewish hive mind that was controlling the world. And that was trying to bring in policies like open door immigration to undermine and destroy white people. And that was the narrative that we bought into. And it, looking back at it now, yeah, it's ridiculous. But at the same time, when you get these other needs met by being in a leadership position, getting national media attention, I was a total attention whore. I was a total narcissist. And that didn't matter who I hurt to get that attention, acceptance, approval, because...
Who did you hurt?
Most of the time, it was white people that were offended by what we were and what we were doing that confronted us. But there was people of all colors that we hurt. And the story that I carry the most shame about is I remember about 17, 18, and we were by the Aquatic Center in Vancouver, and which was a place known for gay men to go cruising. And... there was a bunch of us, and we were drinking, and then, you know, we shouted something at a gay man walking by, and he told us to F off, let's go after him. And so we chased him into this construction site, and he got into, like, a crawl space that was about 3 feet high and sort of scurried into the darkness where we couldn't go after him. And we were like children at the lake, and we picked up stones, and like we were skipping stones at the lake, we whistled them into the darkness, like, clack, 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 clack. And every third or fourth stone, you'd hear this man cry out in pain. And that's how we knew we'd hit him with these stones. And then we got bored after 7 or 8 minutes and walked on. And, you know, I know what it was like to be where that guy was, to know, because I had experienced it in that office, to know that when something really bad's going to happen to you, there's nothing you can do about it, to want to be anywhere else but in that moment, in that terror, in that darkness. And the shame I have is knowing that I'd experienced something similar and felt justified in doing that to someone else. And that's the cycle of violence. The abuser becomes the abused and becomes the abuser. And
do you want the listeners right now to empathize with you?
No. No,
you don't?
I carry healthy shame, and I don't think I'm in a position to ask anybody else for forgiveness. Now, I've spent the last 7 or 8 years of my life atoning and connecting with communities I'd once harmed. You know, just this last September, I went back to the synagogue where I did my very first anti-Semitic act, put a sticker on the front door of that synagogue, and spent time in front of that congregation for an hour and a half talking about what I'd done. And it's not so much about me, and I don't necessarily want people to empathize with me, but to understand that, what's the expression, hurt people hurt people.
What changed you, Tony?
That was started with the birth of my daughter and being in the delivery room, and she gets handed to me, and she's got this little scrunchy face, and she opens her eyes for the first time, and my face is the first picture she's going to take. And I'd connected in that moment with another human being for the first time since I couldn't remember when. I was completely cut off from my feelings. I couldn't recognize or feel my own humanity. How could I possibly recognize it in another human being? But what my children taught me was, you know, with their boundless compassion and their boundless love, and they provided a safe place for me to allow the thawing to happen, because it's safe to love a child. They're not capable of ridiculing you. They're not capable of shaming. They're not capable of a whole host of these other things that happen to us. It's safe. And so there was no risk in me opening up and allowing myself to feel. And we shut off our feelings because it's too painful to keep them open, right? It's a survival mechanism.
So being a dad helped open you to something, but then what came in there and changed you further?
I call that part my disengagement, right? And that's where I left the movement behind in 98.
What made you leave the movement? I mean, it wasn't just your beautiful daughter.
Well, and then I had a son 15 months later, and then I was a single father, and it was because I was so high profile, I had trouble getting work and making an income. And what I realized what I was doing was material impacting the quality of their life.
So very practical.
Very practical choice. But I never dealt with any of the reasons that led me to make the choices that I made. And that came about 7 or 8 years later. And I became a financial advisor in 2004. And I started going to these personal development workshops and dealing with the ego and getting out of your own way and the law of attraction and that kind of thing. And I really hit it off with the guy who was teaching those. He was a psychologist, and he was from England, from Manchester, about 10 years older. So we bonded over all kinds of weird, quirky Monty Python things, and as weird English people do. Mm-hmm. And after about 8 months, my friend who had introduced us gave me a gift certificate. And, you know, I open it up, and it's a gift for my birthday, a gift certificate for a one-on-one counseling session. Like, who doesn't want therapy for their birthday? It's the best birthday gift ever. So I go into this session, and I got to know the guy, and I've also learned that when people find out about my past, it often ended the relationship. And I'm not complaining about that. I deserved it because I did awful things. So I'm telling about my childhood, telling about this and that, and then I'm like, should I tell him the rest? And I'm struggling with it, and he goes, you know, you look like you got 3 golf balls in your throat. It's okay. Whatever it is, spit it out. It's safe here. And so I started telling about being a skinhead and Aryan Nations and all and the violence and everything. And the more I tell him, the more he smiles. And I'm getting kind of irritated, annoyed, and it's my first time in any kind of therapy. And I kind of go, what's so funny? And he comes in with this big grin on his face, and he goes, you know I'm born Jewish, right? And we see in the stories of former violent extremists of all stripes, those two stories of the birth of a child and receiving compassion from someone who we don't feel we deserve it from, particularly if it's someone we had once dehumanized, as having really powerful effects. He held me accountable. And if it wasn't for him, it wasn't the time I spent for him and him pushing me and kicking my ass a lot, I don't think I would have gone public and talk about my story in the way that I do now. And he held me accountable till I got to the point where I was holding myself accountable at the same time.
We're talking with Tony McAleer, a former white supremacist, now executive director of a group called Life After Hate that's dedicated to helping people leave the violent far right. And you know, we have a significant white supremacist neo-Nazi movement, not just in the Pacific Northwest, but in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about this group? You've spent time in Seattle.
Yeah, I spent time in the 80s and early 90s down here with, back then it was white Aryan resistance skins and stuff now, but I think there's always been this Portland, Seattle, Vancouver interchangeable, you know, groups and people. And
it might surprise some people who think of this as a corridor of liberalism.
Yeah, but it's got its dark underbelly, that's for sure, even all the way up into Blaine. And you know, these, and we're not just talking alt-right, we're talking violent far-right, we're talking people with a capacity and a thirst and a weaponry. But in all of that, you know, Seattle also has some solutions, right? And Life After Hate is here this weekend, and we're spending time with a company called Possible in Seattle. And they've done some really fascinating AI stuff with IBM's Watson.
Yeah, artificial intelligence?
Algorithms and intelligence. So this thing goes out and is able to identify tweets that are hate speech and people who are centers of influence on Twitter. And when it finds those and somebody posts something that's very hateful, it will post a thing saying, if you retweet this, we're going to give a dollar to Life After Hate to fight racism.
Uh-huh. I've heard about that, like at rallies, or white supremacist rallies. You've heard that for every step you take, we're going to donate money to the following groups.
Yeah, that was Exit Germany. You know, whatever the metric. I know San Francisco's got Buck a Nazi.
That's satisfying, but how do you know it's helpful to do the Buck a Nazi thing?
Well, ridiculing them, I'm not so sure is the greatest idea, because if shame is the cause, is more shame the solution? And I don't think it is.
Yeah, I don't know if ridicule or shame is the right word. But there's a feeling to it, like, ha ha, we're going to use your retweets against you.
Well, what they found is, I think it's a 40% drop in retweets of content that had that message put in front of it. So it is materially affecting how much the stuff gets spread on the internet.
So if it's making a Nazi angry, that's worth it, because at least that social media channel it's having results.
Well, if he's used to getting, you know, 2,000 retweets and he only gets 1,000, that's harm reduction, right? It's there's less of it moving about, and it helps create funding for Life After Hate, who is able to go and do interventions and outreach and reel these people back in who are where we once were. And at the core, they're human beings. And, you know, I think it's very important to understand that compassion needs to be accompanied by healthy boundaries and consequences. If we have compassion without that, it's really an invitation for abuse. You know, it's like if you have all justice and no mercy, or all mercy and no justice, it doesn't work. But when the two are married together in a healthy way, it's very powerful.
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out, I think, a lot of us. What's the healthy way to combine strong action and compassion? Just one little example, we had the punch a Nazi debate in Seattle. Were you aware of this last year?
Well, I think it's been a national debate.
Yes, absolutely. But this guy in Seattle was wearing a swastika and got punched, and unless it was all a hoax, which some people believe. But I interviewed the man who got punched, and he said, I'm not a Nazi. It's an ancient peace symbol. I'm not hateful. I have a right to free speech. And many listeners pointed out, I just gave this guy a platform to dishonestly recruit new followers. And I apologized for doing that. But do you think we should keep far-right violent extremists off the air?
Well, and again, you know, from the propagandist point of view, I was an attention whore, and I sought out at every possible opportunity and that type of attention. And
are you saying you do think the media should starve these extremist groups of a platform?
Yeah, I think that's an effective tool because it's oxygen for their flame.
Well, most of our listeners are not contemplating punching Nazis or anyone, but they are, I think, asked over and over to build bridges and start conversations and get out of your bubble. And I've heard people say, no, I don't need to understand Nazis. They don't need to understand me. You, Tony McAleer, you go talk to the Nazis. You guys speak the same language, but the person listening, you know, what do you want of them? Can't they just go and live their lives?
Well, what I would say, and I think this is a challenge for every human being, forget who the person is in their lives. Do an act of kindness or compassion for someone who you don't feel deserves it.
That was key for you.
Yeah, someone else did it for me. And
what would be an example? What would anyone listening do compassionately for a violent?
Maybe it's a homeless person. Maybe, I mean, every...
Oh, okay. Not for a neo-Nazi.
No, it could be a neo-Nazi. You have to be careful because they're violent and easily provoked and all that kind of thing. But I think the world needs more compassion. And when you go and do that, pay attention to how it makes the other person feel, but also pay attention to how it makes you feel. You know, I think the hardest thing in the world is to have compassion for someone who has no compassion. But aren't they the ones that need it the most? And I know, you know, people say once a Nazi, always a Nazi. But the data doesn't show that we've helped hundreds of people redirect and deal with their anger and where they're at. And people can come back from that. And it's not changing their mindset. That gets done in time. But, you know, the first thing to do is to help them feel human again.
It sounds like you want listeners to welcome former alt-right members into community. Otherwise, I mean, you want these people to be happy and have jobs and friends and someone to go to the movies with, right? I mean, you don't want them to be isolated.
No, and those former alt-right people, you know, that we've dealt with, they have to do an awful lot on their part to be able to have that communion too. It's not all one way. And they have to step out of that world. And, you know, we help them rehumanize, right? If a head of lettuce grows up to be, you know, deformed, we don't blame the lettuce. You know, was there enough water? Was the soil, arid? There's a whole pile of things that go into that lettuce not turning out right. And we try and understand how it happened.
But if a plant is poisonous, it's scary, whether I blame it or not. I mean, for example, Tony, I am not a perfect person. I can be lazy and self-regarding, but I've never turned on people in this way that you describe, and it scares me a little. Like, so, you know, do you get that from people? Like, well, I don't know what you're capable of, Tony. If I just feel it, it feels scary.
What I was capable of.
What you were capable of. What if your things just, you know, you... I hope not, Tony, but you lost your job and your partner leaves you and no one's joining your life after hate group. I mean, do you feel still susceptible to this?
No, not at all. Because I'm no longer disconnected, you know, and I'm connected to humanity where I wasn't then. It's an issue of, is the person connected to humanity or are they disconnected? And what we help them through that process of reconnection, rehumanizing. It can be frightening. We're talking often with emotionally damaged people, but if they can do the and it's not easy because I'm still peeling away the layers of the onion to completely get to that healing part. And when we face our fears and our pain as human beings, and go there and have that look at those extremely distasteful things about ourselves that we, you know, I'm disgusted at the things that I've done. But if I continually hate myself for the things that I've done, then I'm still have this unresolved anger within me. And that can't help but to spill out onto other people around us. And I think, you know, to quote Dalai Lama, you know, the more I have compassion and forgiveness for myself, the more I diminish my capacity to do harm in the world. And I'm not worried about myself going back. I've got the tools, the understanding, and the connection within myself. It's, you know, a sense of healthy resilience. I'm not susceptible to that anymore. Facing your pain is always a brave journey. And I think it's a journey that everybody can take. And when you take that journey, life opens up and becomes so much better. And, you know, and watching these people that we help transform, I'm filled with a sense of hope. It seems hopeless right now, but I don't feel despair, and I don't feel there's a lack of hope. I actually know that as human beings, we can get through this, but we have to go outside our comfort zone in order to do it.
You're how old now, Tony?
50.
50. What would 20-year-old Tony have said if he could be listening to you right now, quoting the Dalai Lama and Martin Luther King Jr. and interconnectedness?
What would he say? That's a great question. I think what he would say is he wouldn't believe it. You know, that it's fake news. You know, deny the existence of it, because I think to my younger self, that I would make that journey and be authentic with that journey would be impossible. I think it's a journey that nobody seems to believe.
You get skeptics?
Yeah, I get skeptics. But if anyone cares to look at, you know, what I've done and, you know, the things that I've said and, you know, I've been, you know, vulnerable, you know, and I think my life is an open book. And I know that from the mistakes that I've made in the past, there's so many lessons for so many people to learn at the same time that I have an obligation to be open and vulnerable and leave nothing. You know, there's no questions you can ask that are taboo as far as I'm concerned. And I wouldn't have believed that this journey was possible, but it is possible. And one of the mission statement for Life After Hate is to inspire people to a place of compassion and forgiveness for themselves and for all people. If we have compassion for everybody over there and not for us, that's about ego. That's about being seen to be compassionate. When we have compassion for ourselves and nobody else, that's narcissism. And I think as a society, when we look for understanding in every racist mass shooting, but if it's a Muslim person, there's no look for understanding. It's, you know, it's terrorism. That kind of shows that we sort of have a narcissistic society in the way that we look at things like that. And it has to be in balance. And I know the hardest thing in the world for me to do is to have compassion and forgiveness for myself, knowing what I've done.
What do you want to say to 20-year-old Tony?
That it's all an illusion. And the power you think you have isn't power at all. And the attention you're getting, it's none of it is real. And all it will do is bring sorrow and pain to you and to everyone around you and to the world. And it's not worth it.
Tony McAleer, no longer a white supremacist, head of Life After Hate, dedicated to helping people leave the violent far right. Tony, thanks a lot for sharing your story and your thoughts here.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and that's our show for today. The show made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow we're going to have Pepper Schwartz on the show, KUOW's esteemed love and relationship specialist. Looking forward to that. Stay tuned.